Verse 2, why was this man born blind? Was it a result of his own sins or those of his parents? That's pretty harsh, isn't it? Kind of makes Simon Cowell or Craig Revel Horwood sound tactful. The disciples asking that of a man born blind. But it's so true to life. It doesn't put the disciples in a good light. That's not what this is about. John's account is reported, warts and all. That's what they thought. That's what they said. For all, he says this, it was not because of his sins or his parents' sins. That's not why it happened. The denial of a causal link, absolutely emphatic. When my niece was diagnosed with inoperable brain tumours, what would Jesus say if we asked that same question? God, why is this happening to Rachel? Is it her sin? Is it the sin of her parents? And Jesus would simply say, wrong question. You're asking the wrong question. Another incident that really had an impact on me at the time, a boy I used to teach brutally attacked an old lady that lived near the school. And that old lady might have said, why me? Why did I suffer such a brutal attack? Was it something I'd done? And the answer in the Bible is no. But there is a genetic solidarity amongst the human race, going right back to the very first humans. And the consequences of each of our actions collide and bump into each other and affect everyone else. So that boy I taught is a clear example. He'd been abused by a series of men. There'd been an absent proper male figure in his family, like many East End families since the Great War, when so many men were killed. Now, I'm not excusing his behavior. All I'm saying is that the events leading up to that seemingly random mugging of an old lady at least had some origin in the pride and the aggression of politicians who precipitated the First World War, and way, 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 way back to the first humans on planet Earth. We are all linked to each other. And similarly with brain tumors and with blindness. The first people who rebelled against God, they introduced a fracture into this world. And the consequences of that come tumbling down, hitting some people really hard, missing others a little bit more. And it's why suffering just seems at times to be so random. We're all linked. Okay, Jesus says, it's nothing to do with his sin or his parents' sins as such. I've got something far more interesting. He knows that actually the works of God are going to be displayed. And that's what he says. He was born blind so that the works of God would be seen in him. Pretty confident, isn't it, for a man born blind? He talks a good game. But he knows, verse 5, that as the light of the world, he can make this guy see physically, but also to see spiritually, to see who Jesus is and to really know him, to know he is the Christ. So just as the light of the world dispels darkness from this man's eyes and heart, we do see a brooding darkness. Because just as this light's shining, the darkness is trying to overcome it. Within hours of this needy man being made physically and spiritually whole, we have the religious leaders here plotting to murder Jesus. There's a real edge here. Did you notice that? There's a frisson, isn't there, in what's going on? But Jesus isn't afraid of them. He actually deliberately spits. In fact, he's not being crude. When I was first going out with Ruth, I playing a lot of rugby, and I would sometimes clear my nose without a tissue, and Ruth thought that was utterly revolting. And it's not that Jesus is like being macho and spitting. He's issuing a challenge. To apply spittle to a man's eyes is forbidden in rabbinic law. And more to the point, he's doing it on their holy day, on the Sabbath day. He's deliberately drawing their gaze. He's issuing the challenge. Not least, I think, because he knows it will be partly their reaction to him that will help this man to sift the evidence and follow Jesus. Well, so much for the miracle. Spits and his in the mud, puts paste in his eyes, he goes to the pool of Siloam, washes, and he sees. And it's so straightforward. Okay, what about the man? verses 8 to 38. Now, we've got four little conversations here that we're invited to eavesdrop on. And in each one, you see the man considering who Jesus is and moving with the evidence. But be ready for the twist. First conversation, 8 to 12. It's between the man and his neighbors and the townsfolk, basically those who knew him best. So notice the incredulity, verses 8 and 9. His neighbors and others who knew him as a blind beggar asked each other, "Is this the same man?" They can't believe that he's been healed. Of course they can't. It's interesting, isn't it? They're still talking as if he's not there. Is this the same guy? And he's all the time saying, "I am the same man. It really is me." And throughout this kind of conversation, he's an honest broker. You notice that in verses 11 and 12? He knows what he knows. He knows that he was blind. He knows that he can see. But he doesn't know who this man Jesus is, where he's come from. But the point, simple point is this. The people who knew him confirmed it was him, and he was blind, and he can now see. Second conversation, verses 13 to 17. We've got the man born blind before the Pharisees, and they make him retell his story, which he does. But they're unimpressed, aren't they, verse 16. "This man Jesus is not from God, for he's working on the Sabbath." See, Jesus here is totally offending their sensibilities. They're religious people. They'd set up various rules, added rules to God's good gift of a day off. Jesus has violated their fixed ideas, and they're not going to go with Jesus. They're going to go with their own religious sensibilities. Now, that's important for us. It's very easy to point the finger, isn't it? We see something that seems a little bit absurd. But we do have certain culturally conditioned prior assumptions, things that we've perhaps been believing about Jesus and about God for many, many years, perhaps since we were in the playground at school. Maybe that all religions lead to God, that Jesus was just a good man, that the New Testament was written hundreds of years after Jesus existed. But what do we do when there's a clash of authority? When our culturally conditioned sensibilities, perhaps developed since age 8, are then challenged by the greatest figure in world history, Jesus Christ, as he walks off the pages of this story tonight and confronts us with who he claims to be? What do we do? Do we change our mind, knowing that many of our sensibilities are just culturally conditioned? Or do we say, no, they are permanent? And rather than yield to the authority of Jesus, we stay rigid. Now, I think, obviously, it's a loaded question, but I think we've got to be open to correction. Even some of their own number is quite striking here. They ask, well, if Jesus was simply an ordinary sinner, verse 16, how could he do such a miracle? That's a great one. That's a great question. And it causes the man to take the next step. So in verse 17, they throw the question back to the man born blind. They're cornered, so they won't answer that question themselves. They take the coward's way out. And they say, who do you say he is then? And he says, I think he must be a prophet. He's made a bit of progress. In verse 11, he refers to Jesus as the man. When he hears this conversation, he can't just be a man. Nobody, unless they're from God, could do this. He thinks, got a point there. Not a bad argument. Yeah, he's a prophet. So he's moving gradually into the light. There's nothing like blind prejudice begin to nudge you in the right direction. So this man's eyes are gradually opening spiritually, moving with the evidence. So third conversation, verses 18 to 23. The Pharisees don't like where this is going, do they? They don't like the answers from the eyewitnesses. They don't like the answers from the man born blind. So they get his parents. And here it gets a little bit farcical, a bit like an old Monty Python sketch. Let's just read it, verses 18 through to 23. They still did not believe that he'd been blind and had received his sight, until they sent for the man's parents. Is this your son? They asked. Is this the one you say was born blind? How is it that now he can see? We know he's our son, the parents answered, and we know he was born blind. But how he can see now, or who opened his eyes, we don't know. Ask him, he's of age, he'll speak for himself. His parents said this because they were afraid of the Jewish leaders, who already had decided that anyone who acknowledged that Jesus was the Messiah would be put out of the synagogue. That's why his parents said, he's of age, ask him. Is this your son you say was born blind? I mean, they're inferring that maybe the parents of this man got it wrong. I mean, that is a really absurd thing to suggest. Now, I've got five kids. I'm married to an artist. And sometimes we did send our kids to school not quite in the right school uniform. And yeah, maybe on occasions we could have been accused of a little bit of neglect in that direction for not being absolutely pristine with the school uniform. But to not notice that your child is blind, that's pretty unbelievable. I mean, if they hadn't been so afraid of the Pharisees, you could imagine them being a bit more plucky and saying, oh yeah, come to think of it, yeah, he did struggle a bit at school, was a bit clumsy, and was especially challenged during games. We always put it down to the football boots being too tight. Well, of course we know he's our son. Of course we know he's born blind. You don't make a mistake about that. But they don't, because they're scared. Now, it's good that we're smiling and laughing at that situation, because the Pharisees are not. They refuse to acknowledge the absurd conclusion to which their assumptions have driven them. They're not driven by evidence. They're driven by blind prejudice. And that's how they managed to give us this wonderful fast. If you're in a relationship and you begin to get into a bit of a standoff, let me just be honest here. Many times in my marriage, I've got offended pride, wounded ego, and I have a bit of a standoff, and it's only a little bit later on that I realize how ridiculous I'm being. And it's only when I manage to laugh at myself that sometimes the light can come in and the relationship can be restored. But the frightening thing here is the Pharisees are not laughing. Now, maybe you've still got those opinions about Jesus you formed when you were 8, and you haven't had them challenged properly yet. They really should be. You know, when I was 8, I thought girls were utterly stupid. I thought they were horrid. I was sorry about that. But the great thing is, I've changed my mind. Well, I think it's great because I've married one. I've been married to that same girl for 34 years. But maybe we should doubt our doubts. Maybe we should be capable of sometimes laughing at the absurdity to which these culturally conditioned sensibilities have driven us. Now, I know we all tend to rationalize our position post hoc, which is fine. We all do it, but so long we're open to being challenged. But don't be blinded by the light. Don't be blinded by the evidence of who Jesus claims to be, and I think proves himself to be. Okay, finally, the fourth conversation, 24 to 34. If you look at that, a second time they summon the man who'd been blind. Give glory to God by telling the truth, they said. We know this man is a sinner. He replied, whether he's a sinner or not, I don't know. One thing I do know, I was blind, but now I see. Then they asked him, what did he do to you? How did he open your eyes? He answered, I've told you already, and you didn't listen. Why? Do you want to hear it again? Do you want to become his disciples too? Then they hurled insults at him. You are this fellow's disciple. We are disciples of Moses. We know that God spoke to Moses, but as for this fellow, we don't even know where he comes from. The man answered, now that is remarkable. You don't know where he comes from, yet he opened my eyes. We know that God does not listen to sinners. He listens to the godly person who does his will. Nobody's ever heard of opening the eyes of a man born blind. If this man were not from God, he could do nothing. To this they replied, you were steeped in sin at birth. How dare you lecture us? And they threw him out. He is just astonished, isn't he, at their culpable blindness. The inference here is that Jesus is illegitimate. We don't know where he's come from. Who's your father? Who's your father? Who's your father? Referee, we used to hear on the football terraces. That's kind of how low it's got. And he says, that is remarkable. You don't know where he's come from. Yet me, a man born blind, and I now see. Why don't you become his disciple? They can't stand it, so they throw him out. He becomes persona non grata, verse 34. He's denied all social and civic privileges. So the blind man has now seen the emptiness, the bitterness of those who opposed Jesus, who had their own early cancel culture. He's misspoken. He's taken a wrong step. He is now cancelled. He is out. There's no grace. There's no forgiveness. It's cost him his place in society, but Jesus, verse 36, comes to him. And the hairs must have been standing up on the back of his neck when he realized this wasn't just a man, wasn't even just a prophet. Notice what happens here. Jesus heard they'd thrown him out, and when he found him, he said, "Do you believe in the Son of Man?" This is a vision of God, no less, that's anticipated in the old part of the Bible, the Old Testament. "Who is he, sir?" the man asked. "Tell me, so that I may believe in him." Jesus said, "You have now seen him. In fact, he is the one speaking with you." Then the man said, "Lord, I believe." And he worshipped him. He realizes God in human form is standing in front of him, of course. Who else could do this but God himself? And by virtue of this story, Jesus, by his Spirit, stands in front of all of us tonight. And he actually says, look, you are made in God's image. You are made for God, and all of your hearts are restless until they find rest in God. Well, you see, I'm not just a man, a person of history. I'm not just some other prophet. I'm actually the Son of Man, God in human form, the Messiah. Will you bow down and worship me? So I wonder where we're at. Are we at verse 11? If we're at verse 11, Jesus is just a man, we're pretty blind. If we're kind of moving with the evidence and we think, well, he must have come from God, verse 17, yeah, that's a good step. But if we stay there, we really aren't much better than only half seeing. We have to get to the verse 38 of falling at his feet and worshipping him as God. This is none other than God on his own planet. So how can you and I have that spiritual sight? How can we be made spiritually whole? How can we actually see spiritually and know Jesus? Well, the simple thing answer from here is to do as we're told. That's what this man did. Verse 7, he allowed Jesus to put mud in his eyes, and he went to the pool of Siloam and washed. He could have said, look, stop your quackery. I'm a hopeless case. If you want to impress your followers, why don't you go and get someone else? Maybe somebody who's got a little bit of dust in their eye. They'll believe that. Please, don't mock me. He could have said all that, couldn't he? But he somehow, I don't know, he somehow believed even better than he knew at that stage, and he did as he was told, and he came back seeing. We could feel that way about the death of Jesus. We could think, well, Calvary, Jesus dying on a cross? How can that bring the forgiveness? How can that somehow take away God's settled indignation and wrath against our rebellion and all the sin of this world as we've destroyed this beautiful blue planet or in the process of doing so? How could Jesus' death achieve that? He says, look, at this stage, you don't need to understand it. Just go and wash. Go to the cross. Because that is the... Excuse me, I'm struggling tonight. Any water anywhere? That is the only place. I said, Ruth's got a bottle. Thank you, Ruth. That is the only place you can get forgiveness. Thank you very much. My niece, Rachel, who has incurable brain and spinal tumors, she was a keen ballet dancer when she got the news of her cancer and the treatment, and she subsequently wrote a reflection which has been published. And here's a short extract from it. She says this, "The treatment to get rid of the tumors was to last a year, a whole year. I was likely to feel sick for a large chunk of that time, but that wasn't the worst. I would lose my hair, all of it. I shook it out, sadly, pulling a lock and holding it against my thigh. Optimism drained away quite suddenly. I could put up with everything else, but surely I didn't have to lose my hair. There was no mistake, it was the future I had to face, but I wasn't ready for it. For the first time, in hospital, I cried and cried. Into my pillow, into my mum's arms, to God, to anyone who would listen, my sadness was overwhelming. It was a time of crisis. Who should I speak to? There was my mum, but I'm a teenager. You don't pour your heart out to your mother, do you? I wondered who to call. Lots of fantastic friends had said I could call them at any time, but this was mid-morning. Most would be at school or at work. Then I remembered my friend John. He'd be at home. He was a retired sea captain. He had a friendly round face and short white beard, and he looked a bit like Captain Birdseye. He came straight round. I told him everything as I cried and shook with fear. "Hey, stop it," he said. "What are you afraid of, Rachel? What if you do die?" I knew I'd picked the right person. I breathed deeply as I brought myself under control. John wasn't in a hurry for an answer. I thought quietly to myself. I was afraid of pain. I'd had enough of that already. But I had no need to be afraid of dying, had I? I thought back to when I first understood that Jesus, God's Son, had died in my place. I thought it incredible that God could love us all so much, where mostly we take no notice of him. I remember going home and quietly praying to God in my room. I'd thanked him that Jesus had taken my punishment and had asked him to make me his child. Since that day, I'd been certain that God was with me, whether things were going well or badly. I knew if I died, God would give me life forever. I looked up at John and said, "I'll go to heaven." It's quite a powerful story, isn't it? Of a child who at that stage thought she was dying. Now, if you're not yet a follower of Jesus, there's an awful lot on this week. If you're a student, well, I don't really care. I'm happy to invite you into this tent outside the library. Just sneak in, put a bit of makeup on, pretend you're a mature student. If you don't look like a student, they're letting me in each night without any ID. Each evening, is it 7:30? Somebody tell me, 7:30, nodding. There is a program Ruth and Sam and others are playing, interviewing different people, an academic administrator from the university, a student, a major general from the army, somebody who served a life sentence for killing a man in a street fight, and then more encounters like this. Maybe that is a good next step for those of you who are students. If you want to take that step towards the light, seeing who Jesus is. And the shocking thing is that if we don't make sense of the evidence, if we go in the wrong direction, if we go away from where the evidence of John's gospel, for example, takes us, we become blinded by it. Sorry to have to finish with difficult words, but this is how this section closes. Verse 39, "I have come to judge the world. I've come to give sight to the blind and to show to those who think they see that they are blind." You see, Jesus' words are a double-edged sword. They have an intrinsic capacity to divide the human race into two. Those who acknowledge their spiritual blindness and helplessness and their offense against God and go to the cross, they see and they're forgiven and they're accepted and become spiritually whole, like Rachel, like the man born blind. But the second group, and all of the human race divides into these two groups, upon considering something like this, one of these signs actually leave blinder than before they heard it, perhaps even offended by the light of this evidence. "I've come to judge the world. I've come to give sight to the blind and to show those who think they see that they are blind." Well, the great thing is that Jesus is not only big enough to meet our need of forgiveness, but he's near enough. Because this gospel is true, it's powerful. It's powerful enough not just to give assurance to a child with brain tumors, to a man who's been cast out of society, but to you, whoever you are. Because it's a true word, it can be embraced. And by it, you can know that Jesus is the Christ and have life in his name. We're going to sing the story of a remarkable man. He was a slave trader who saw himself rightly as a terrible wretch, but he saw that God's grace was even greater than his sin. And you'll know it, it's a famous hymn, "Amazing Grace, how sweet the sound that saved a wretch like me."